The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder about that pesky first half of the Bible called the Old Testament. The New Testament is okay. You like Jesus' talk about love and mercy and forgiveness in the New Testament? Yeah, sure, that part is cool. But the Old Testament? That's a whole different story altogether, especially the part about punishment. Why were so many nonviolent offenses punishable by death in the Old Testament? If God is really a God of mercy and forgiveness, why was capital punishment such a common practice under the Old Testament law? You can understand putting murderers to death, but the law of Moses did not stop there. Sexual sin was also punishable by execution. So was the disobedience of children. Well, my friend, you raise a very fair objection. Nobody can deny the importance of this question. It is extremely sympathetic. It keeps honest seekers from accepting the inspiration of Scripture. It also puzzles Christians and Orthodox Jews who accept the entire law of Moses as the Word of God. Yes, even Bible believers who defend God's right to exhibit His wrath have an impossible time defending such practices. We accept that humans are sinful. We accept that God is within His rights to fry all of us at any time, should He so desire. But therein lies the problem. He has no such desire. So much of the Bible is spent on God proclaiming His love and forgiveness. Any honest listener must admit that these passages with a contrary tone do not seem to fit the mainstream of Scripture. We'll examine this provocative question later on in today's program. First, the latest news, and guess who's back in the news? Anthony Weiner. Yeah. Now, I know what a lot of you are thinking. I know what you're thinking as if I was sitting next to you. You're going, Bob, Bob, Bob. That's sensationalism. That isn't newsworthy. My friend, normally, I would agree with you. Scandals and sexual fidelity are nobody else's business other than the family that it involves. That is true. As a general rule, but when a man asks for public trust, when a man seeks a high political office, we have a right to assume that if he'll lie to his wife, he'll lie to us as well. In fact, he already lied the first time he was caught. But even putting that aside, there's more to this story than meets the eye. So hear me out for a few minutes, then we will go on to other news items that I would agree also are more important. In the midst of an attempt to re-enter the world of politics by running as mayor of New York City, Weiner was sideswiped by a tabloid website entitled The Dirty. Well, you can just imagine with a title like that, the kinds of stuff The Dirty would uncover. The Dirty swiftly pulled the wind out of his Manhattan Island sail by posting X-rated text messages from Weiner, including a picture of his crotch, which was exchanged with a woman over the internet. This creates a nauseating sense of deja vu in the minds of American citizens who thought Weiner's previous exit from public life an appropriate one. Weiner has admitted to sending these newer messages, which went out last summer, quite some time after he resigned in disgrace from the White House, because of similar pictures sent via Twitter, pictures which he first denied and later confessed after the evidence became indisputable. Weiner says, I want to bring my vision to the people of the city of New York. I hope they are willing to still continue to give me a second chance. Correction, Weiner. This was your third chance, but who's counting? Not your wife, evidently. She acts like the repeated offense is just another in a series of casual boo-boos. Huma Abedin said her husband had made some horrible mistakes, both before he resigned from Congress and after. She has decided to stay with him, even though it was not an easy choice. Why is she sticking by her man? Well, here are her own words. I love him. I have forgiven him. I believe in him. To take her words at face value, we are either witnessing an extraordinary second helping of unconditional love or a naivety rivaled only by a battered wife who assumes her husband has changed simply because he buys her flowers. While some might be moved to tears, others are considering another possibility on the part of Mrs. Weiner, her suspicious connections. Being the wife of Anthony Weiner is not Huma Abedin's only foray into American public life. She also served as deputy chief of staff to Hillary Clinton while Clinton was Secretary of State. And during that time, evidence came forth that Abedin's mother was connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization sworn to the destruction of Israel and the forcible spreading of jihad. The source is outspoken Palestinian ex-terrorist Waleed Shubat. Several Republican United States congressmen, including Trent Franks, Michelle Bachmann, and Louis Gohmert, asked for an investigation of Huma Abedin's connections back in June of 2012. They were sharply rebuked by Senator John McCain, and these are the words of John McCain. These allegations about Huma and the report from which they are drawn are nothing less than an unwarranted and unfounded attack on an honorable woman, a dedicated American, and a loyal public servant. The letter and the report offer not one instance of an action, a decision, or a public position that Huma has taken while at the State Department that would lend credence to the charge that she is promoting anti-American activities within our government. These attacks on Huma have no logic, no basis, and no merit, and they need to stop now. Well, yeah, you tell him, John. All right, perhaps Senator McCain is right. On the other hand, Huma Abedin might have learned a thing or two from Hillary Clinton about the benefits of standing by an unfaithful husband in the hopes of satisfying personal political ambition. If such ambition is connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, American citizens have a right to know. It's just that simple. The jury may still be out on this matter. Even if Huma Abedin's mother is connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, we should not automatically indict the daughter, but it is just as unfair to quickly dismiss the claim. Unless you want to assume that Anthony Weiner displays some incredible quality at home, known only to his wife, the words of an ex-terrorist such as Waleed Shubat should be looked into. Ex-terrorists put their lives on the line when they make allegations. I have interviewed Waleed Shubat on this very radio program. People should pay attention to men like him. They are usually careful while choosing which facts are worth dying for. Meanwhile, a lot of people think the whole Zimmerman-Trevor Martin case is something worth dying for, or at least something worth raising havoc over. Even our president has disgraced himself by getting involved. As usual, the Obama administration, touted in 2008 as the administration that would heal racial division in America, is helping racial matters about as much as a screaming child helps a headache. In what some would call an unconstitutional example of double jeopardy, George Zimmerman may be tried a second time for the same crime by Obama's Justice Department. The excuse being floated is that the first time Zimmerman was charged with second-degree murder, while this brand-spanking new charge will be violating Trayvon Martin's civil rights. Supposedly, Zimmerman was more than an overly ambitious volunteer night watchman with a hero complex. He went after Martin simply because the young teen was black. Yeah. Yeah, sure he did. Now I'll tell one. A decision has not yet been made, but President Obama's finest appointee, that paragon of legal virtue, Attorney General Eric Holder, is actively looking into the matter. Relax, everybody. Eric Holder is on the scene. Justice will be done at last. Never mind that no racial motive was proved in trial one. Never mind that Zimmerman's call to 911 was not consistent with a man dead set on committing murder. Never mind that the FBI has already investigated and found no racist motive as evidence. Our efficient and dedicated government will ignore inconvenient facts and push full steam ahead. Although few thinking people separate Eric Holder from his boss, Obama's press secretary is making every attempt to do so. Jay Carney said, "This is a decision made by the Justice Department, by career prosecutors. This is not something the president involves himself in." Oh, really? Actually, Mr. Carney, that ship sailed a long time ago. Obama interjected himself into the discussion back when the tragic shooting first occurred by saying, "If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon." Inasmuch as Trayvon's picture does not particularly resemble Obama, the strange statement sounded like the kind of racist remark liberals love to accuse conservatives of. Does Martin look like Obama's son only because they share the same skin color? Can you just imagine the media buzz had George Bush identified with a dead teenager simply because the man was white? Chris Matthews would have a whole month's supply of editorial soliloquy. Whatever the interpretation of Obama's comment, it served to fuel racial discussion into an incident that originally had nothing to do with race. Now, prior to Carney's remarks, Obama said, "I know this case has elicited strong passions, and in the wake of the verdict, I know those passions may be running even higher. But we are a nation of laws, and a jury has spoken. I now ask every American to respect the call for calm reflection from two parents who lost their young son." Well, that sounds good, Mr. President. That sounds great. So why didn't you stop with those words? How come you keep on flapping your big yap? How come you don't keep your mouth shut? Are you trying to exploit the situation? Are you hoping that by joining the ranks of race baiters like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, we'll forget about Benghazi or the IRS scandal or Fast and Furious? And there are a lot of others, but who can keep up? And how about reining in your attorney general? While considering charging Zimmerman all over again, this time with a civil rights charge, Holder said, "We are determined to meet division and confusion with understanding and compassion and also with truth. We are resolved, as you are, to combat violence involving or directed at young people, to prevent future tragedies, and to deal with the underlying attitudes, mistaken beliefs, and stereotypes that serve as the basis for these two common incidents. And we will never stop working to assure that in every case, in every circumstance, and in every community, justice must be done." Folks, I think I'm about to cry. You know, actually, truth is not the first word that pops to mind when people think of Eric Holder. That particular quality seemed absent when he testified about Fast and Furious and the AP Fox scandals. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
Is thinking of trying Zimmerman a second time. That would be a contradiction to our Fifth Amendment, but the law doesn't seem to concern Holder a lot. He talks about truth. People don't think of truth when they think of him. He talks about justice. Well, did Holder see to it that justice was done when people complained about voter intimidation by the new Black Panthers? Shamar Shabazz, head of the Black Panthers chapter in Philadelphia, was caught on a 2010 video, holding a baton in front of a voting poll and shouting racial slurs while explaining to a reporter that he was there for security. And then another video surfaced showing him calling for the murder of white babies. He says, you want freedom? You're going to have to kill some crackers. You're going to have to kill some of their babies. Now, this man and other Black Panthers were prosecuted by the Bush administration. Then Obama became president. Yippity-doo-da-day. Under Holder's leadership of the DOJ, the government dropped all charges. Isn't that nice? Is this Holder's idea of compassionate justice? Now, folks, nothing here should be a surprise. Where racial relations are concerned, Holder, right from the start, had displayed more of an agenda and less of an interest in truth. One of his early comments after being appointed Attorney General was that America needs to have a serious conversation about race. Those insightful words were delivered right after we elected our first African-American president. Not that our country needed to prove that we had already abandoned the legal persecution of African-Americans long ago, but this was the liberal litmus test, remember? Hey, America, are you finally going to rise above your racism and elect a Black man? And then, after Obama's election, the first thing we heard from our new Attorney General was that we were still a racist country needing to have a dialogue. Dialogue. Oh, sure, they want a dialogue. Sure they do. True conversation is an invitation for both sides to listen. Holder isn't interested in a dialogue. He's interested in offering a patronizing, self-righteous, sanctimonious lecture. A real honest-to-goodness conversation would point out that racism can come from many people, not merely whites. When Martin's friend said under oath that he described Zimmerman as a white cracker, was that racism? When white people are beaten up in riots only to hear the words, that's for Trayvon Martin, are we witnessing racism? Even if Zimmerman had been a racist, would that mean that all white people were guilty? On the other hand, was Zimmerman dubbed racist only because of shameless race baiting? When the New York Times learned that Zimmerman was part Hispanic, well, you can't call an Hispanic racist. See, only white people are racist. So this posed a little dilemma. It was Hispanic on Black, not white on Black. What? Oh, what was the New York Times going to do about that? Oh, well, then they came up with a new term. They just called him a white Hispanic. And in doing so, painted the case in terms of white against Black. Were they race baiting? When the original 9/11 recording showed that Zimmerman made no mention of Martin's skin color until asked by the dispatcher. And when NBC News edited the tape to make it sound as if Zimmerman was profiling Martin simply because of color, was that race baiting? Mr. Holder, these are the incidents that deserve discussion. But alas, such matters would only concern an attorney general who talks about truth and justice a little less and practices it a lot more. In your case, just practicing it occasionally would be a step in the right direction. But there's nothing right about the direction of a recent immigration bill, even though it's certainly been touted that way. A recently passed Senate immigration reform bill seems to strike a balanced solution to immigration with provisions to satisfy both sides of the political aisle. Indeed, many prominent Republicans helped to craft the newly proposed law, which passed by 68-32. Those who instantly equate bipartisan legislation with good legislation will feel as if Christmas came early this year. Closer inspection reveals some of the bill's finer promises. There's a 13-year path to citizenship, which will at least bring undocumented workers out of the shadows. There's a series of hoops that will have to be jumped in order to make citizenship a reality. These include financial compensation through fines and taxes. That doesn't sound so bad. At long last, a frustrating situation will come under practical control. American citizens concerned about border security might feel encouraged to sleep better at night. This bill has something for everybody. $38 billion is allotted for 40,000 new Border Patrol agents, along with an extensive arsenal of high-tech surveillance equipment. These are supposed to reduce illegal immigration by 33-50%. According to Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, a champion of the bill, the big problem with immigration is convincing people in the country that it won't turn into a 1986 endgame. Now, why did he mention 1986? He was talking about an earlier immigration reform under President Ronald Reagan, We were promised that the border would be rescued under that bill, too. Graham, Marco Rubio, and other Republican champions of immigration reform believe that with this new bill, they have avoided the errors of 1986. Since Democrats and Republicans alike admit that something had to be done about the problem of undocumented workers, this latest legislation seems to be about as grand and comprehensive as a person could wish for. Yes, it seems that way. But perhaps we shouldn't celebrate quite so fast. There is one small problem with this bill. More correctly, one small clause in the bill which provides the key to a massive problem. Let me read this to you. Notwithstanding paragraph 1, nothing in this subsection shall require the secretary to install fencing or infrastructure that directly results from the installation of such fencing in a particular location along the southern border if the secretary determines that the use or placement of such resources is not the most appropriate means to achieve and maintain effective control over the southern border at such location. Now, some insist this humble little clause will not take away from at least 700 miles of mandatory fence. Others disagree. Attorneys are haggling over what the fine print actually means. But to a casual observer, the translation seems obvious. The new law's border requirements will absolutely, positively be met, but only in as much as the governing administration deems it necessary. My friends, if you think securing our border is a priority of the Obama administration, you believe in a fantasy that the Brothers Grimm would not have been able to sell to Mother Goose. In case your memory needs refreshing, this is the same President Obama who back in 2012 denounced an Arizona immigration law allowing police to ask for records when they stop people and then report such information to ICE. Obama's contempt for that law and refusal to cooperate have been made abundantly clear. This is also the same President Obama who promised that he would stop deporting illegal immigrants who came to America as children so long as they meet certain requirements. He then gave a speech about how this decision was not really amnesty. This is not amnesty. This is not immunity. This is not a path to citizenship. It's not a permanent fix. Obama sure has a way with words. This wasn't amnesty because he didn't call it amnesty. It may have resembled amnesty. It may look and act exactly like amnesty in every remote detail, but well, it just wasn't amnesty. And who can forget the Obama administration's position on mandatory voter identification? His own attorney general compares such requirements to a poll tax. We are not left to speculate whether or not securing our border is a priority to Obama, but it's anybody's guess why Republicans fall for Democratic promises more often than Charlie Brown trusted Lucy with the football. A note to Republicans in the House who can still stop this train. In your desire to court Hispanic voters or compassionate liberals, be careful not to sell your party's soul as if it were another item at the Dollar Tree. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric, Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric. We're talking about the immigration bill, and I'm giving a little message to the Republicans in the House as if they're going to listen to me. But I mentioned before the break that in their desire to court Hispanic voters or compassionate liberals, they should be careful not to sell their party's soul. My Republican friends, you will be demonized no matter what you do. You may as well just do what is right. True immigration reform is fine. Just beware of Trojan horses embedded in the bill. The first clue for Republican senators should have been that Charles Schumer was offering to work with them. The second clue should have been Obama talking as if he plans to sign the thing. But nobody has offered more warnings and clues about societal danger than the insightful novelist George Orwell. In his brilliant novel, 1984, Orwell predicted a time when people would have no more privacy. He also foresaw a society that would invert word meanings to conceal the truth. Today, for instance, the word security is tied to both sides of Orwell's vision. Security from terrorists is an excuse to strip away privacy. The NSA's vast storehouse of private data is not an invasion of privacy, supposedly, but rather a means to protect privacy and liberty, along with security. Well, I think privacy is in short supply these days. While the Fourth Amendment should flash like a neon light, such modern illumination did not exist in the time of our founding fathers. Those who view the Constitution as a living, breathing document love to remind us that electricity in those days was mostly associated with Ben Franklin's kite. Therefore, according to the SPIM, newer technology warrants an upgraded interpretation of our beloved legal document and its stubborn amendments. One such modern invention is the telephone. While America's NSA justifies obtaining phone records as a necessary means of tracking terrorists, we must keep in mind that the phone is no longer a single device. Those who grew up in the 20th century became accustomed to a wide variety of necessities and luxuries. In addition to phones, they had typewriters, which gave way to computer word processors, radios, television sets, still photo cameras, home movie projectors, record players, which became CD players, VCRs, and GPS devices for cars. Today, every one of those functions is available through a single invention. It may be called a smartphone, but it's an entire complex of smart machines reduced to one small device that fits in the palm of your hand. This snappy-looking gadget also allows us to do less exercise. Trips to the post office are replaced with email. Banking can be done online. Travel agents have been replaced with a screen that responds to a few pushes of the finger. Smartphones do not yet toast our bread, but nothing would be a surprise anymore. New technology is astonishing, and it certainly offers a lot of conveniences. Unfortunately, it also funnels almost everything we do through a single electronic gateway, making our daily work and recreational habits much easier to monitor. While technology is itself neutral, we must pay attention to exactly who is using or exploiting the tool. A hammer is harmless when it nails wood together. In the wrong hands, a hammer can kill a person with one swift blow. In a rare display of bipartisanship, conservatives and liberals are joining ranks, finding strange bedfellows on both sides of the aisle. Some liberals who objected to wiretapping under Bush try to remain consistent by denouncing Obama when he does the same thing. Conversely, a fair number of conservatives who defended Bush find themselves in the uncomfortable position of supporting their current president. It is tempting to conclude that thoughtful, bipartisan Americans are faced with only two options, either the defeat of terrorism or less privacy. Well, are those really our only two options? Actually, my friends, there is a third alternative. We can accept that the war with militant Islam is real and fight as much as possible, all the while avoiding self-destruction. America must not battle for freedom and suppress freedom at the same time. Maybe a dictatorial police state can stop every potential act of terror and cry victory. But a free society settles for the silver medal, a significant reduction of terrorism. Face facts, a limited government, as called for in the Constitution, cannot monitor every single public institution 24 hours a day. Less surveillance need not translate into less resistance. When terrorists are apprehended, they should be met with swift, severe punishment. This would be a refreshing alternative to further restrictions for the innocent majority. Instead of snooping through emails or asking old ladies to take off their shoes at airports, why not make matters painfully inconvenient for the terrorist himself? Maybe when a terrorist confesses his actions and brags about his holy mission for Allah, we can try him as a military combatant instead of providing a civilian trial with an open forum where he pontificates at the taxpayer's expense. If the military were to hang him before he gave his speech and let the entire world watch, courtesy of cable and satellite television, other potential terrorists might just think twice. This will never happen. It will never happen under the Obama administration, and it's unlikely to happen under any future president. But the spirit of the idea still holds. America should be harsh with her enemies, not her citizens. Preventive measures should also be taken within reason. Now, supposedly we heard some of those reasons a few weeks ago. While testifying before the House Standing Committee, National Security Agency Director General Keith Alexander commented on PRISM and other NSA programs, which have recently gone under the microscope for obtaining information from the likes of Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Verizon. Alexander defended the actions as limited, focused, and subject to rigorous oversight. He also said these programs have protected our country and allies over 50 times since 9/11. Well, that sounds great. That just sounds Jim Dandy. What sane person can honestly object to terrorist suspects being spied upon and subsequently stopped? There's no reason to doubt Alexander's word. Certainly some terrorist plots have been thwarted. But a bigger question remains. Is this where the surveillance will stop? On paper, the government can obtain phone records, email records, etc., but they're not allowed to examine any private details without first obtaining a warrant. Supposedly, we should trust that the Obama administration will not go beyond its legal boundaries. With this proposed trust, we arrive at the core of our dilemma. After all, Obama and the law have made interesting sparring partners during the past few years. Under Obama's watch, ICE has often refused to enforce the law with illegal immigrants. Law-abiding American citizens seems to concern our president far more. Obama has spoken out against Fox News, conservative talk radio, and others who dare to challenge his helpful ideas for transforming America. Speaking of media, Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder was caught in a lie about putting pressure on news outlets such as Fox and the Associated Press. Obama still refuses to remove Holder from office. Maybe he figures that if people have forgotten Fast and Furious, they'll let this one go as well. And how much fun has the IRS been during the Obama administration? They put up impossible demands for tax-exempt applicants who were sympathetic to the Tea Party, pro-life causes, or even the Nation of Israel. In some cases, applicants were asked to supply a list of all donors and a complete record of Facebook conversations. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Yes, there needs to be surveillance on terrorists. Can the Obama administration be trusted not to go too far? The same administration that won't enforce the illegal immigration problems we already have? They put up impossible demands for tax-exempt applicants who are sympathetic to the Tea Party or other things. In some cases, applicants are asked to supply a list of all donors. We talked about this right before the break. All donors, a complete record of Facebook conversations. Mosques, on the other hand, are not being investigated. Well, easing up on mosques should come as no surprise. Obama has more or less declared the war on terror is over. We must define our effort not as a boundless global war on terror, but rather as a series of persistent, targeted efforts to dismantle specific networks of violent extremists that threaten America. Well, who are these extremists that keep Obama up at night? His concern seems rather fleeting where Egypt is concerned. Obama has warm relationships with President Morsi, who claims Jews are descendants of apes and pigs. Morsi also represents the Muslim Brotherhood. If they aren't a terrorist organization, the word terrorist should be removed from the dictionary. Meanwhile, matters seem pretty extreme on the anniversary of 9/11. Al-Qaeda itself attacked the Benghazi consulate. Nevertheless, between the White House and the State Department, somebody was responsible for ordering a planned rescue operation to stand down. In the days that followed, a lie was circulated to make the attack look less like terrorism and more like a spontaneous response to an anti-Mohammed video. Ambassador Susan Rice was not the only one floating this story. The noses of Obama and Secretary of State Clinton were also growing. And who can forget Fort Hood? This was somewhat of an extreme incident. Nadel Malak Hassan, an army psychologist, shot and killed 13 people. God forbid the Obama administration should ever call this an act of terror. Instead, it was labeled domestic violence. Never mind that Hassan was crying Allah Akbar while shooting his fellow soldiers. Never mind that long before the shooting, Hassan gave a PowerPoint presentation to Army soldiers where he said, "We love death more than you love life." Now in jail awaiting trial, Hassan is still receiving Army pay, while his victims do not even qualify for the Purple Heart. Should American citizens trust the Obama administration with phone and email records? Should Obama get away with talking out of both sides of his mouth by using the war on terror as an excuse to invade privacy, even though the war on terror is supposedly over? Does he really seem concerned about foreign invaders, or have most of his efforts been aimed at domestic critics? If your analytical mind can't come up with an answer, perhaps you should Google the questions from your smartphone. Okay, returning now to the theology question that I read at the beginning of our program, let's switch gears. Why did God command capital punishments for so many Old Testament offenses? Although many today object to any kind of capital punishment, most people will admit that putting somebody to death for cold-blooded, calculated murder is vastly different than mandatory death for a sexual offense or mere rebellion on the part of children. And yet these darker, more ominous commands are crystal clear, at least upon first glance. I'm reading from Leviticus 20. If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death. Exodus 21. Anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. Deuteronomy 21. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of the town. They shall say to the elders, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a profligate and a drunkard." Then all the men of this town shall stone him to death. Okay, now, the ages of the children are not given. People did continue to live with their parents, even as young adults. They were gathered into clans in those days. So we can relax at least a little bit here. God is not talking about stoning some toddler for throwing a temper tantrum. Be that as it may, stoning even a young adult for a mere rebellious attitude still staggers the imagination. And the capital offenses did not stop there. People were stoned for blasphemy, worshiping false gods, seeking the guidance of a medium, and many other things. All right, I'm going to startle my listeners and put them at ease all in one sentence. Are you ready? With the exception of murder, I do not believe the ancient Hebrews felt compelled to carry out capital punishment for any other offense, provided genuine repentance took place. Now, maybe this idea sounds too good to be true and impossible to defend. And just keep on listening. You may be surprised. A good place to start would be Jesus himself. How did he react when confronted with a legitimate situation for capital punishment? Well, the Apostle John gives us an opportunity to find out. The specific trespass was adultery. In John 8, we read the interesting and popular narrative in which the Son of God actually rescued a woman who was about to be stoned to death. Jesus did not seem to condone the flat-out stoning of a self-confessed adulterous woman. And yet, if it was really an expectation of the law, he should have condoned it. It says, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" All right, now, technically, these rabbis were correct. Under Moses, adultery was punishable by death. I just read that to you. Of course, it's also true that Jesus came to introduce a new covenant that would supersede the law of Moses, but that covenant was not yet in operation. You see, even though we read about Jesus' ministry in a book that we call the New Testament, the Old Testament, or covenant, old agreement, was actually still in operation at the time, and Jesus was honoring this older testament. Any future changes under the new covenant would not be set into place until Jesus' death on the cross. At that time, the curtain to the Holy of Holies in the Jerusalem temple was supernaturally rent in two, signaling an end to the law of Moses and beginning of the gospel age. The way into God's presence was no longer acquired through a high priest once a year. Jesus himself became our ultimate sacrifice and ultimate high priest. Through his blood and forgiveness, anyone can now enter God's presence. Prior to those pivotal moments of history, Jesus spoke very respectfully about the law. He said, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." Yes, Jesus was in the process of setting up a whole new arrangement in which adultery or any other sin could be forgiven, but at the moment, God's commands as revealed through Moses prevailed. And although atonement for sin was also offered under Moses through the sacrifice of animals, certain sins were still punishable by death. Adultery was one such sin. If Jesus taught his disciples to continue obeying the law until everything is accomplished, in other words, until his death on the cross, then he had no reason not to cooperate with the stoning. And yet, something was obviously up. The motives of the rabbis were disingenuous, and Jesus knew it. It says they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. We'll talk more about this when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Well, just as Clint Eastwood used to ride in and be the hero of every movie, Jesus rode in and rescued the woman caught in adultery. Under the law of Moses, she should be stoned to death. It says, when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, Those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Okay, it is important to point out that Jesus still commanded her to stop sinning. He was not at all condoning the action of adultery. Instead, he was stressing God's forgiveness and showing that one particular sin should not be isolated as if certain actions keep us from God's grace more than others. Naturally, this incident offers a rather obvious hint for the gospel of grace that will characterize the primary message of Christianity. It also highlights religious hypocrisy and the arrogance of people thinking they are somehow less sinful than others. Still, once again, we cannot escape the Old Testament era in which this incident is taking place. Not only was Jesus forgiving the woman, he seems to be in disagreement that capital punishment is necessary at all. Otherwise, why not tell the woman that although she must die, she'll still end up in heaven? If Jesus' actions protested the form of punishment, indeed, if the very setup was only an attempt to somehow trap Jesus, we're left with an important question. How seriously did any of the Jews take their capital punishment laws as far as sexual sin was concerned? The answer to this apparent paradox may be a lot simpler than one would guess. It is true that God literally commanded capital punishment for a wide variety of offenses. It is also true that a financial penalty could be offered as a substitute. If the guilty parties paid monetary restitution, they could avoid being put to death. You see, when God delivered the Hebrews from Egypt, it was very important to introduce a radical change of lifestyle. People needed to understand how sinful they were before a holy God. In all likelihood, capital punishment was ordered so that the Israelites would have an understanding of the depth of their sin. In other words, God wanted them to know that certain practices were so heinous that the offenders deserved to die. Once the fairness of the verdict was understood, God in his mercy had no problem accepting a lesser penalty. In Exodus 21, we read about an offense deserving the death penalty. We also see financial compensation as an alternative to death. It says, if a bull gores a man or woman to death, the bull must be stoned to death and its meat must not be eaten. But the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring and the owner has been warned but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or woman, the bull must be stoned and the owner also must be put to death. However, if payment is demanded of him, he may redeem his life by paying whatever is demanded. Now, long after the time of Moses, financial substitution continued as a practice. Notice the words of an unnamed prophet to the wicked King Ahab in the book of Kings. As the king passed by, the prophet called out to him, "Your servant went into the thick of the battle, and someone came to me with a captive and said, 'Guard this man. If he is missing, it will be your life for his life, or you must pay a talent of silver.'" Now, the exception was murder. In the case of intentional murder, no financial substitution was acceptable. Numbers 35, do not accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who deserves to die. He must surely be put to death. So you think, well, okay, Bob, so far this looks quite interesting, but just because financial restitution was accepted with some offenses, should we assume this was the case with everything? That's a good question. Yes, I would make exactly that assumption. First of all, if murder is listed as the one offense uncovered by financial restitution, the implication is that all the other offenses can be satisfied with money. You're thinking, all right, Siegel, well, that makes sense, but can you point to a verse which states this precisely? No, I cannot point to one verse where this truth is explicitly stated. However, a reading of several verses together makes a great case that this practice was assumed by the Israelites. One particular Old Testament law went to the heart of justice and fairness. In fact, America, present-day America, would do well to adopt this same law for all criminal offenses. It says that if a man falsely accuses somebody of a crime, he will pay whatever penalty the accused might have suffered. I'm reading from Deuteronomy 19. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse a man of a crime, the two men involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and the judges who are in office at the time. The judges must make a thorough investigation, and if the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against his brother, then do to him as he intended to do to his brother. You must purge the evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. Okay, now getting back to the subject of sexual immorality, we see the same system of justice in operation. Notice what happens when a man falsely accuses a woman. If a man takes a wife and after lying with her dislikes her and slanders her and gives her a bad name, saying, I married this woman, but when I approached her, I did not find proof of her virginity, then the girl's father and mother shall bring proof that she was a virgin to the town elders at the gate. The girl's father will say to the elders, I gave my daughter in marriage to this man, but he dislikes her. Now he has slandered her and said, I did not find your daughter to be a virgin, but here is the proof of my daughter's virginity. Then her parents shall display the cloth before the elders of the town, and the elders shall take the man and punish him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the girl's father, because this man has given an Israelite virgin a bad name. She shall continue to be his wife. He must not divorce her as long as he lives. If, however, the charge is true and no proof of the girl's virginity can be found, she shall be brought to the door of her father's house, and there the men of her town shall stone her to death. She has done a disgraceful thing in Israel by being promiscuous while still in her father's house. You must purge the evil from among you. Okay, folks, the subtle truth should be obvious. If this woman was indeed guilty, she was deserving of death. If she wasn't guilty, then according to what we previously read in Deuteronomy 29, whatever penalty the woman might have incurred will instead be administered to the false witness. And yet, does the lying man get stoned to death? No. Instead, he pays financial restitution. Okay, let's add it up. A, the man deserves the same penalty that the woman would have received had she been guilty. B, his penalty was satisfied with the payment of money. Therefore, C, we conclude that her penalty could also have been satisfied with financial restitution. Once again, the capital punishment was described only to show the seriousness of the crime. Of course, not everybody could afford a monetary penalty. In such cases, others could pay on their behalf. Now, there was no need for Jesus to pay for the woman caught in adultery. She had not been brought before any official council. This was mob violence. In fact, under the Romans, Jewish leaders were not allowed to carry out the death penalty anyway. And it's true that sometimes matters got out of hand and Roman officials looked the other way, as in the case of Stephen's stoning. So Jesus' rescue and bravery are still noteworthy, but financial restitution was no longer an issue. We still see Jesus challenging the very heart of capital punishment. He does so by pointing out the hypocrisy of the crowd, not by reminding them of what the Romans will or will not allow them to do, and yet the principle was still the same. After all, Jesus did pay for the woman's trespass in a much more final manner. He died for her sins on the cross. As you can see, the ultimate expression of forgiveness exhibited in our Savior was foreshadowed in the Old Testament. Rather than showing us a harsher God, we see the same God with the same love and mercy offered to undeserving human beings. Okay, in the few minutes we have left, I have a couple of comments. Over a month ago, I did a special program about same-sex marriage. This was before the Supreme Court issued their ruling. As a companion piece to that radio program, I also wrote a series of 4 articles for Washington Times Communities. The title of the first article was, Can We Disagree Without Being Viewed as Hateful? And wanting to set the right tone, I told people that I respected their opinions, and I asked them to try to imagine that they could have a conversation with somebody without assuming that that person is hateful. My first response letter came from the Center Against Domestic Violence. Never in my life have I advocated that anything violent be done to homosexuals, but this is how people take an invitation to have a friendly debate. The letter said, Bob Siegel is a filthy bigot. Sir, the filth and the bigotry comes from you, who cannot handle a dissenting opinion, who has to judge the heart and motives of somebody he doesn't know simply because he disagrees. This next letter is from a man who calls himself Hypocrisy Question. He says, the definition of traditional marriage has been changed repeatedly through the years. Go watch Fiddler on the Roof for a few examples. My friend, all that means is that the definition of marriage has been changed before. That is a completely neutral observation. It says nothing about the right or wrong of the situation. It says nothing about my points in the article, the other 3 articles that it's linked to. Write us again sometime. maybe next time you'll actually have something to say. And I will see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.